Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The first presidential debate took place on Wednesday night. The media declared Mitt Romney the winner, even though several outlets fact-checked his claims and found several lies. Rolling Stone's Tim Dickinson came up with a list, including pre-existing conditions are covered under my plan, and I don't have a $5 trillion tax cut. Taxes took up almost half of the conversation on Wednesday. Columbia Journalism Review's Ryan Chittum writes that, quote, nobody can figure out what exactly Mitt Romney wants to do with taxes. His plan is mathematically impossible, and Wednesday night's debate just confused matters even more. The Atlantic's Matthew O'Brien looks at an undercovered issue. Romney would cut corporate taxes by about $1 trillion over a decade, and most of the benefits would go to the very richest. Joining us to discuss coverage is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and tax expert. He is the author of two bestsellers on taxes, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And his latest book is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And last month, David had a column in Reuters called Romney and Ryan on Taxes, in which he goes over their plan specifically. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Rose.
Nice to have you. And we are also joined by Josh Idelson, a freelance journalist and contributing writer for Salon and In These Times. Josh has been covering the Walmart strike. For the first time in 50 years, Walmart workers in Southern California walked off the job yesterday. Last month, Walmart warehouse workers walked off the job. And on Monday, workers in Elwood, Illinois, were joined by supporters for a 600-person rally. Those who nonviolently blocked the entrance to a major Walmart distribution hub were met by cops in riot gear, and 17 people were arrested. Josh reports that employees protesting working conditions and retaliation are flexing their organizing muscle, but the first of its kind strike carries risks. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we like to start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So David, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Monica Davey has a piece in the New York Times today, and I'm sure the Chicago papers had earlier pieces, about the unknown marijuana farmer who planted two football fields of very well-tended marijuana plants right in the city of Chicago, and nobody noticed as some of them grew big as Christmas trees.
Wow.
and the reason I think that story is intriguing is that it tells you that often the most egregious crimes, and it is, after all, a crime to grow marijuana, occur right under our noses, and our law enforcement people don't even see them. And this happened to be found by a police helicopter pilot who was intrigued by the by the color he saw down below of the plants. But this wasn't spotted early on or anything else. I mean, they have this clearly had been in operation for a long time. And I think it just goes to recognizing that, you know, you're never going to have a perfect world in law enforcement. You're never going to stop every crime. You're not going to stop everybody who wants to bring down a jetliner.
Wow, I'm looking at the photo right now, and there's this huge tractor trailer in this big field. So what exactly happened? When did they crack down?
They discovered this a couple of days ago.
Okay.
What happened is the helicopter pilot's report prompted the authorities to go out on the ground, and now they're using earth-moving equipment to tear it all up and haul it away. But clearly this had been there a long time with nobody noticing.
So kudos to Monica Davies with the New York Times, and we'll put a link on our website right after the show. And what about you, Josh? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought my colleague at In These Times, Mike Elk, had an excellent story, a disturbing story about what he called PTSD counselors forced to attend anti-union meetings on troubled Army base. This was a story about the Fort Lewis McChord military base, which has a history of being tied to some of the worst incidents of both suicide and attacks on civilians related potentially to PTSD. Here you have mental health professionals who've tried to organize to deal with issues around workload and what they say is intentional pressure to drop clients and to mark people as healthy who aren't, and union busting that allegedly both violates labor law and specifically allegedly violates the prohibition on spending taxpayer dollars on these captive audience meetings, where you force workers to sit on the clock and be told why they shouldn't be in the union. So it's unfortunately a common trend, even among government contractor employees, that we see this. And what he wrote is an important story in these times.
How did he get wind of this? Do you know?
The union that's involved, the International Association of Machinists, participated in the story. He talks to a former employee on the record, and he talks to multiple employees who asked to be anonymous for, I would argue, really the best reason in the country, pretty much, that someone can request and be granted anonymity, which is when it's a worker who potentially would be fired for exposing their boss.
Oh, wow. Kudos to, I wonder if anything will happen because of this report. Has it been reported before?
To my knowledge, it hasn't.
Okay, well, maybe we should invite Mike. He's been on the show before. We should invite Mike on in the coming weeks. Kudos to Mike Elk with In These Times. Thanks for that, Josh. And we're going to be joined by a reporter with The Guardian, Rory Carroll, in just a couple minutes to talk about the election in Venezuela. But before we do that, I'd love to hear both of you talk about just what you thought of the media coverage of the presidential debates. And I noted, David, that the media declared Mitt Romney the winner. And then you've got, I just searched for Mitt Romney lies debate. You've got so many outlets writing about the lies in the debate. And when we did our show about debates on Thursday, a number of listeners wrote in saying, how can the media declare someone a winner when he lies? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a debate is a theatrical event. And as a dramatic event, Romney did very well and the president did not. There's no two ways around this. You notice a couple times during the debate, I noticed that he was searching for words, and it did make me wonder if he came without being properly rested. And as one of my best friends said to me right after the debate, you know, let's hope that we find out the reason is that he was busy in the Situation Room figuring out how to kill the people who killed our ambassador in Libya, which we, of course, wouldn't hear about until it happens, as with the killing of Osama bin Laden. But he did not do well. He's not a very good debater to begin with. And Romney, remember, made his fortune in part by selling deals, getting people to put up money and closing deals. And Romney did very well. The fact that the president did not go back after Romney is being explained away by his staff, particularly David Plouffe, or Plouffe, I guess. I'm not sure how he pronounces it, as part of a strategy to get Romney on the record about these things. But the fact is they had 60 million people watching, and I think that was the time. But Barack Obama is a man who believes in being the first postpartisan president. He wants to be Mr. Compromise. And while I or you might have been right in Romney's face and called him out, that's just not who Barack Obama is, and he'll live with the consequences. By the way, the polls do not indicate that there's any dramatic shift from in voter attitudes after the debate.
So what did you think about the claims Romney made about taxes? As Tim Dickinson reports in Rolling Stone, he basically said Romney flatly lied about the cost of his proposal to cut income taxes across the board by another 20%.
Well, one of the things I've been pointing out to people is that, first of all, Romney isn't even consistent about his plan. On his own website, RittenRomney.com, on different pages, he says, cut all tax rates 20%, and on another one, he says, maintain current marginal rates. But, you know, the way you measure the tax cut is, what is the tax cut? And a 20% across-the-board tax cut over 10 years comes out to about $4.8 trillion, $5 trillion in round numbers. And for him to say that's not the case is absurd. What he's trying to do is argue that it won't be that much because I'm going to limit deductions. Well, as the president pointed out, you can limit, take away all the deductions for people like Romney, who, by the way, the deductions he took were twice what his income tax bill was, and had he deducted all of his gifts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it would have been almost three times what his income taxes were. So we have a situation where he's conflating separate issues. He's conflating, well, I'm going to take away your deductions but cut your tax rate, And then he wants to count the balance. But, you know, he hasn't told us what he's going to do in terms of what deductions is he going to take away. Is he going to take away the home mortgage interest? I somehow think Congress is not likely to do that, and the real estate lobby is likely to make sure that doesn't happen. Is he going to take away your 401k plan? That would not seem to be consistent with his views. Is he going to take away tax deductions for health insurance? No, he's made pretty clear that he wouldn't do that. This is absolute nonsense to put the kindest notion on it, but we don't count a tax cut based on what you take back somewhere else. We count it on the tax cut, and Romney absolutely flat-out lied when he said, I don't have a $5 trillion tax cut, unless you want to be technical and say it's $4.8 trillion.
And, Josh, what did you make of the coverage? You focus on labor issues. What did you make of what the candidates claimed about job creation specifically?
I mean, I think this is one of these moments where you have to ask yourself, what is the media for, right? Mm-hmm. It's old news that there's an obsession with the horse race, that there's not enough attention to policy. But particularly when you have an event, as David said, where 60 million people are tuning in, many people are tuning in for the first time. And so if, for example, Mitt Romney, who ran as a candidate of the hard right, positions himself as the guy who agrees with anything that you liked about Barack Obama, and the media just marvels at how effective this might be, or journalists air their view, which there's no particular evidence for, but their view that this was always the real Romney who's finally coming back, then you're participating in the misleading of voters by denying them the context. I think particularly on the jobs question, it's just striking how divorced this debate is from the actual jobs crisis, the fact that Europe gets invoked by Romney as an example of what happens when you have too much debt, when you don't do enough austerity, when actually what we see in Europe is the terrible consequences of austerity. We still have a debate when the moderator is to blame, but candidates are also to blame, where we're talking as though there's a short-term debt crisis when there's actually an unemployment crisis. And this debate continued that theme. It stuck on that premise, and there wasn't enough critical voice from the media in terms of talking about what actually is the immediate crisis.
And that is Josh Idelson. He's a freelance journalist and contributing writer for Salon and In These Times. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest book is The Fine Print. And now I would like to welcome Rory Carroll to the show. Rory is U.S. West Coast correspondent for The Guardian. He's just back from Venezuela, where he's been covering the presidential elections. On Sunday, Venezuelans are going to the polls. President Hugo Chavez is seeking a third term, which would extend his term to 2019. And he's already been in power for 14 years. Hi, Rory. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So I wanted to ask you, Rory, before we jump in and talk about the elections in Venezuela and the elections here. We always start off on a positive note on Friday and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
In terms of printing or in terms of in the U.S.?
Any outlet.
Yeah, I thought, let me think. This would be controversial. I thought Jim Lehrer's moderation of the debate was actually okay. I think you've got any person in North America who thinks that. I thought he was, he just let both candidates speak. He didn't interject himself. He didn't make it about him. He gave them the platform to speak. And actually, I thought he did a rather good job. But I realize I'm in a minority of one, and there are 300 million Americans who seem to think otherwise. But,
yes, I think so.
I give Jim my vote.
Let me break in. I agree with Rory. I actually thought it was good that we didn't stick to these rules and we let them have more at it with one another. I thought that was a tremendous improvement.
Well, yeah, we did a show about that on Thursday. We got a lot of complaints about the format itself. And Rory, to dive in here and talk a little bit about the Venezuelan election, which is taking place this Sunday. We're going through an election, obviously. We have the debates. What would you say, what is it like in Venezuela in terms of ads, debates? What are the major differences?
Frankly, it's kind of in some ways, it's another planet. Firstly, there are no debates between the two candidates. The opposition candidate, Henrique Capriles, is the state governor. He has asked for debates, but Chavez has scornfully refused that, saying an eagle does not hunt flies. Because he just feels that this guy's beneath him, and so really there's no point having a debate, so of course there aren't any. But what you do have is a very, very electric atmosphere in the country, and this is and has been for a long time a very polarized country. There is a revolution underway, and very broadly speaking, about a third of the population adores Chavez, a third detests him, and then you have a floating third in the middle. And the campaigns are desperately trying to mobilize their cores on both sides and to appeal to this kind of floating middle. And this makes for a very, very electric campaign. And you always know it's there's an election coming up in Venezuela when you go to the supermarkets and the people, you know, queues of people ahead of you stockpiling tinned food, bottled water, batteries, torches, and so on, because people are worried about the aftermath. They don't know what the outcome will be on Sunday, and secondly, they don't know whether mayhem may well erupt or whether things will kind of bumble on very quickly afterwards. So for that reason, there's a sort of clenched tension in the streets, and it's the sense that people just don't know what's going to happen, because they've been bombarded on both sides by the selection. Because in Venezuela, you have these caravans of support. People, both campaigns organize huge rallies all across the town. It's in towns and cities. And just yesterday, Chavez had a huge win in central Caracas, and there are tens of thousands of people there. A few days before, Henrique Capriles had a similar one. So really, that makes for a very polarized, but also very, very exciting election.
Well, and give us a sense of what's going on the ground, because what you get in the media, when you look at sort of the progressive left media, they often talk about how things have prospered under Chavez and how the poor are doing much better. And then when you read the more mainstream media in the U.S., for example, what's getting a lot of attention right now is the fact that voters in the U.S. have to travel to Louisiana to vote because in January the Venezuelan government shut down the consul in Miami. And so a lot of the people that we're hearing that are being quoted who live here say they left Venezuela because of Chavez. So can you just, what is the reality on the ground?
Well, it's not a very original thing to say, but it's in some ways the truth, a little bit between the two extremes. It's often quite depressing for me to hear, you know, the debate is reduced to, like, is Chavez a dictator or is he a messiah? No, he's not a dictator, and no, he's not a messiah. And what he is, if we're to speak firstly on the kind of the democracy side, he's a hybrid. He is obviously an autocrat in many ways, the way he centralized power, the way he will abuse state resources, and the way that a lot of opposition leaders have either been jailed on corruption charges or have gone into exile. But at the same time, he's also a Democrat because he does he survives on an electoral mandate. He needs the legitimacy of an electoral mandate. The one time that he actually lost a vote, he more or less respected it. That was a referendum, 2007. And so, you know, and there is the election is in many ways it's a free election. There's a very vibrant but diminished opposition media in Venezuela that can speak out. So you have this kind of hybrid of, you know, half autocracy and half democracy, and it's certainly not a Stalinist dictatorship. In terms of the fairness of the campaign, I think on voting day it seems that both sides more or less are saying that they think it will be a free election, that people will, the votes will not be stolen, that there will not be stuffing of ballot boxes, and that's not the problem. The problem is in the process leading up to the election, and here it's obvious that Chavez has tilted the terrain in his favor. He will mobilize or may kidnap state resources and use them for his own campaign. He will commandeer the airwaves using a law which obliges all TV and radio stations to carry his speeches live, and he will pretend that this is a state event, but really it's a partisan event. And also there have been some dirty tricks against the opposition, such as closing the Venezuelan consulate in Miami, which is the heart of the Venezuelan diaspora, and this diaspora would poll show overwhelmingly vote for Capriles. So now you have at least 20, maybe 25,000 Venezuelans in Miami who now need to trek to New Orleans if they want to cast their vote. And this is a scene as an example of how Chavez is trying to do everything he can without stealing the election and to tilt things in his favor.
And this morning on NPR, they ran a story about a nonpartisan group that's paying for people to travel to New Orleans because a lot of people say they can't afford it. And almost everyone in the piece, if not everyone, is voting against Chavez.
Yes, I mean, the diaspora, overwhelmingly, a bit similar to Cuba, in that sense, are very hostile to Chavez, and they view him as either, depending who you speak to, as an ogre, as an incompetent kleptocrat, or a dictator. I mean, that's why it was in the interest of the government to disrupt the voting of the diaspora. To go back to the other question about the poverty and what benefits Chavez has wrought over the past 14 years, depending who you speak to, the glass is either half full or half empty. It's half full in the sense that poverty has been dramatic falls in poverty under Chavez. A lot of people, most people are actually better off. Certainly the poor now have, in theory, the access to free healthcare. More schools have opened. There are a lot of state-run grocery stores that offer subsidized groceries. And a lot of people have gotten their jobs in these expanded social programs and education courses. So that's all the good stuff. On the downside, though, is that Chavez had a huge bonanza. He's had about $980 billion in oil revenues. That's not millions, billion. $980 billion in oil revenues over the past decade. And you have to, when you go to Venezuela and look around, you have to ask, where did it go? Because firstly, the infrastructure of the country is collapsing, and there are blackouts, rolling blackouts affecting most of the country every week, and this is due to lack of maintenance of the electricity grid. The roads are falling apart. You have bridges literally collapsing. You've had oil refineries, a series of accidents at oil refineries going up, and there's still a chronic and worsening shortage of housing. And also the economy, meantime, is warping. On the surface, it looks may look okay because growth there this year is about 5%, which is a lot better than it is in the United States. But that's actually because of again these petrodollars, lots of borrowing from China, and the economy has warped from these controls on exchange controls and price controls. Now a lot of those details sound rather arcane, you know, to outsiders. They think of Chavez and they think either he's a demon or he's a fantastic messiah. And you start talking about exchange controls and people's eyes just glaze over. They go, like, what are you talking about? But the truth is that these sort of details have sealed the fate of Venezuela's economy, which is now buckling under all these weird distortions, which means that actually there are few and far between a proper jobs. You go to the industries are suffering. A lot of the land reform program is very ambitious. The government expropriated 3 million hectares of land, and it's just not working. In industry and agriculture has suffered under Chavez, and for that reason, the country is more dependent than ever on oil imports. That's 96% of its export earnings are dependent on oil. Now that all sounds kind of nerdy. Forgive me, but actually that's so important. That's actually the
right. It is important, and you don't really get that perspective in the U.S. media. And David, I'm wondering, do you follow this at all? And what are your thoughts on what happens when the media defines a country through its president? I mean, you also rarely hear, and Rory does include this in his pieces, that in 2002, the Bush administration backed a coup. That's also rarely in the U.S. media.
Well, you know, the U.S. has a long history of treating every country in the Western Hemisphere as its proxy to do with as it pleases, and we've been overthrowing governments. We created Panama because the rulers of Colombia wouldn't play ball the way we wanted in building the Panama Canal, for example. Most foreign reportage reduces things to fairly simple issues, but it is intriguing that Chavez has been made into such a cartoon character in the American media. I am fascinated by one thing Rory said. He said 96% of
David,
the
hold that.
Earnings.
Hold that yeah. thought. I'm sorry. We have to take a quick break, and we'll come right back. We're talking today. It's our media roundtable, and you can join us 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
How would you like to listen to KALW on your iPhone? Well, you can with the new Public Radio Tuner application. It's free, and you can find out all you need to know at KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show, yourcallradio.org. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with consumer activist Ralph Nader. He's out with a new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. We will speak with Mr. Nader about what it will take to shake up the U.S. political system. Do third parties have a future, and how can we most effectively use our power? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us today for our weekly media roundtable, 866-798-8255. Rory Carroll, the U.S. West Coast correspondent with The Guardian, who's just back from Venezuela, will be with us for a few more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about media coverage of the Sunday election in Venezuela, we'd love to hear from you. And then we'll speak more later in the show about coverage of the debates, taxes, and the strike in Southern California Walmart stores, the first in its 50-year history. And of course, if you saw a story that you thought deserved more attention this week, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today, in addition to Rory Carroll, by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His latest book is The Fine Print. He was on with us a couple of weeks ago. Josh Idelson is a freelance journalist and contributing writer for Salon and In These Times. And I'm sorry, David, I had to cut you off before we went to break there.
Well, I'm just curious, before Chavez, and clearly the business class does not like Chavez one bit, probably with some good reason from their perspective, what percentage of their foreign earnings were not from oil? I mean, I was always under the impression that Venezuela was virtually entirely dependent on oil exports foreign earnings.
Yes, before Chavez, it was, as I understand it, 80% of export earnings were dependent on oil. Now it's gone up to 96%. I think two reasons. One is oil prices have obviously exploded over the past decade, so you get more money for your oil. And the other reason is that Venezuela is producing less. It's basically deindustrialized. Recently, I did a tour of Bolivar State, where they've got all these huge state industries, which were built in the 1970s, and have been more or less trundling along for a few decades. But now, I mean, it's just really sad. There are all these kind of big rusting carcasses of warehouses which have been mismanaged, partly because these rolling blackouts, not enough electricity, there's troubles with the unions. And so you have these big kind of inflated, bloated state enterprises which don't work very well. And so Venezuela's not producing anymore. Meantime, same things happen in agriculture. So for that reason, it's quite sad, and I think that's bad news. And almost every economist will tell you that Venezuela is in for a tough reckoning. Regardless who wins on Sunday, the currency will need to be devalued again, and that will make prices even more expensive. And Venezuela's had 961% of inflation. That's, again, 961% of inflation over the past 10 years. And that's a lot, and that's 10 times more on the average of Latin America's big economies over the same time. So you can see there that the economy is just warped into these strange shapes.
And Josh, before we let Rory go, do you have any questions for him?
Sure, Rory. I'd be curious your thought about what happens after Chavez and whether that's part of the discussion. Given what you're saying about the extent to which the polarization at least gets talked about in terms of Chavez personally more so than economic policy, are people talking about what follows him, and will that reshape the politics there?
I'm sorry, Josh, I didn't catch the last part. Could you repeat the question?
Sure. So has the conversation begun among the voters you're talking to about who comes after Chavez, and once he is no longer the candidate, will that change the politics significantly?
Well, that's one of the big worries and concerns for everybody in Venezuela, is that, firstly, the man is clearly not well. He says he is cured of the cancer, but there are a lot of rumors, and just using your own eyes, you think this guy, there are rumors that this cancer is terminal. We don't know even if he wins the election, how long he will live to rule. Now, there are no obvious successors to him within his movement, none. He has anointed no successors. And there are no obvious people around him who could take over and fill his huge shoes. None have his charisma. None have the popularity to straddle all of the groups and factions of his movement. So if he dies, if he wins and then dies in office, it could get very, very messy. So we simply don't know, and that's one of the big unknowns for his movement. And I think that if Chavez dies, when he dies, his movement is finished. I don't think there will be much of a Chavismo without Chavez. It very much revolves around his personality and his charisma.
It sounds like a very tense situation, Rory.
Yes, it is, because when you have any system that revolves around the physical and mental health of just one individual, and institutions have been more or less kind of hijacked to that end, it's not an especially stable system, and especially in this case, if that individual is clearly sick. We just don't know. We're all in a guessing game of, well, you know, if then Chavez dies in office, you know, what will happen? Will there try to be his own supporters maybe trying to keep a coup to avoid a new election or not? And that's pure speculation, but the point is, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And even his own supporters don't know. And a lot of them are worried that, well, if I vote for the commandant, whom I like, but he may die, and then I might get a foreign minister taking over in a few months' time. And we just don't know. So it's a very strange, eerie time for Venezuela these days.
And that is Rory Carroll, U.S. West correspondent for The Guardian. And Rory, can you stay with us for a little while?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. We're going to talk about the debates a little more, and then I just realized you're actually in Los Angeles, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's where the Walmart workers walked out of their stores yesterday. So I'd love to get your take on that, the coverage or lack of coverage. Josh Idelson has been covering that for Salon. And we're also joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on coverage of the debates, taxes, the fact-checking? And did you hear about the Walmart strike? It first strike in its 50-year history. There are some incredible photos of the riot police standing in front of the big Walmart trucks in Chicago, in Elwood, Illinois. So what are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. And if you saw a story this week that you'd like to talk about, if you think deserves more attention, you can post it to yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Linda in Santa Cruz. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I always enjoyed listening to your show.
Thank you.
A lot of provocative comments, and one of them today provoked me to make this call. I am astonished that our media views a debate like a sporting event, and I think this is part of the great illness that afflicts our country right now, that the media people would go for somebody that lies blatantly, puts on a show of aggression, and that we need that to heal this country and our issues. I don't buy that. And I wish the media would just report the facts and keep their opinions out. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Linda. We got several similar comments on Thursday, and I'd love to hear from all of you. David, what would you say to Linda?
Well, you know, you have to separate news reports, which don't have opinions in them. They may have some analysis in them, but generally they don't have opinions in them, from the facts. And the fact is, people know that Romney lied because there are a whole bunch of news reports about it today. And yesterday, as you know, there's the Washington Post, where I was in Washington yesterday, they have a huge a piece of, you know, fact-checking it by Glenn Kessler, for example. The New York Times has pieces about this. The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the papers that I saw in the last 2 days all had pieces about this. Don't confuse the cable television shows, where I often appear, where people are expressing opinion and are labeled as opinion, with the news reports. Now, on the other hand, keep in mind that the reporters who cover politics are political reporters. They want to cover the horse race. That's what they're doing. I don't think that's the way to do it. I think we should do that, but I think it should be a great deal more emphasis on the issues. Mm-hmm. But you know, the fact is that large numbers of Americans just completely have no interest in what the issues are, no interest in what the facts are, unfortunately. But if you want the facts, they're readily available.
Josh, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that most Americans don't have an interest in the issues or the facts?
I think it depends on how it's presented. I think that one of the things, as much as one may disagree with Bill Clinton on policy, and I certainly do and have, one of the things that his speech showed is you can make a relatively detailed argument about facts in a way that people find compelling and tune into and actually affects what they think. And I think with the rise of fact-checking identified as fact-checking, I mean, on the one hand, there's this issue of fact-checkers wading into questions in a sort of specious way, like to say, well, it's not factual to say that this plan ends Medicare, it just replaces it with something else. But I think separate from that is that too often the fact-checking becomes the next day story. The fact-check becomes the sidebar aside from the real story, which is who's going to win. And who's going to win in part depends on how the voters hear the debates and how the candidates act based on the incentives that are created by the reporters. The reporters create incentives for candidates based on how much they do or don't call out when people are changing their position or lying about what their position is.
And Rory, what would you add to that? How would you respond to Linda? You're from Ireland, right?
Yes, I'm from Dublin.
Yeah, we actually had a few people call in yesterday and say that the moderator should be from another country because maybe they would actually ask tougher questions.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I've already kind of weighed in to defend I think it's, I mean, as an outsider, as a foreigner, I mean, the level of razzmatazz and attention to kind of detail and in terms of the horse race in the U.S. is extraordinary. I mean, you turn on the cable channels and the fact that they'll dissect every kind of incidental triviality from, you know, the candidate's tie, the way he walks, whatever, is just amazing. And at some point, I actually get it's a lunatic. But that said, I think it also has a positive aspect, because all that razzmatazz does generate, I think, some, you know, an excitement which otherwise may be lacking. And I think, as David says, people often don't really have much attention or don't devote much attention to some of the great issues. And so you need a bit of showbiz to spark things along. And I think, and I would hope that even, you know, the media's and the focus on trivia, they do somehow, you know, can filter through the trivia. And from that, then they process maybe of osmosis. But, you know, the main message of the candidate.
Rory, we're having some problems with your phone, so maybe, I don't know if you're moving around, but it's starting to break up a little bit. But Linda, thank you for calling. We hear your frustration. Thank you for your call. Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for your taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that for me, the debate was largely meaningless. I'm really noticing ever since the League of Women Voters was kicked out of the debate process 8 years ago, and the debate process has been taken over by a corporation that's run by the two major parties and funded by Bud Light.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, all these other issues which actually could affect the economy, I mean, you know, the war, the environment, other things, have been largely decided are not going to be in the debate. And so we're sort of stuck with this narrow spectrum on taxes and, you know, employment, which, you know, I just didn't really make a lot of sense to me. I didn't see enough difference in the candidates to really get excited. I really think that the entire debate has been tainted by the lack of objectivity by the people who set the rules. And I thought the moderation was just awful. Mm. I mean, you know, I don't think it was actually moderated. I don't know what I would call it at this point. But anyhow, that's my comment. I would like to see, you know, a more neutral, you know, set of rules and, you know, and a third parties. I mean, that's the thing, is that they've changed the rules on third parties. So you're never going to see either a Ross Perot or a Ralph Nader, because they've raised the numbers purposely to exclude other candidates who would offer other perspectives.
And what about media coverage, Mark?
Well, I felt like the media was suffering from the same thing that I was. I mean, it's hard to report anything meaningful about this debate. I mean, Romney was declared a victory because he largely didn't fall down and drool. And, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, you know, I had a lot of trouble connecting with any substantive issues.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Mark. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We've got just about 10 minutes left, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I wanted to talk about the Walmart strike. Someone actually just posted this piece by Stephen Greenhouse on the New York Times. So, Josh, this is now starting to get attention because it all started last month when Walmart workers in Southern California who don't have access to clean drinking water went on strike. They walked off the job. And then on Monday, workers in Elwood, Illinois, were joined by supporters for a 600-person rally. And those who nonviolently blocked the entrance were met by cops in riot gear. And there are all these photos going around showing the big Walmart trucks with the riot cops in front of them. 17 people were arrested, and the New York, the Stephen Greenhouse with the New York Times says that this could be the start of something big. It's the first strike in Walmart's 50-year history. What are your thoughts on that, Josh?
So, as I argued at Salon, what we see really is a new phase in a decades-long struggle between labor, capital L, lowercase l, labor, and Walmart. This goes back months in particular. I mean, look at in June, you had a strike that got very, very little attention, a strike in Louisiana by seafood workers who exposed literally slavery conditions, packing shrimp that ended up getting distributed to Walmart. Walmart originally said they investigated it and it wasn't true. The claims were substantiated by other organizations and Walmart dropped the group. Those eight workers went on strike. That, in some sense, is the beginning of the new chapter of the story, which extends to the warehouse workers in California who struck for 2 weeks. 3 days later, these workers in Illinois who went out on strike and are still on strike at what they say is the largest Walmart distribution center in the United States, a distribution center which is owned by Walmart, but where the workers on paper don't work for Walmart at all. And in talking to workers who went on strike, Walmart store workers, right before they went on strike Thursday, and to Walmart workers in other parts of the country, they said what those warehouse workers did inspired us, and it made us feel like we could do it. And this is significant in part because sometimes in the labor movement there's a mindset that workers from different crafts can't really identify with each other in the same way. Here you have people who in some sense are doing different kinds of work, but are all dealing with understaffing, are all, whether or not on paper they work for Walmart, are all subject to Walmart's lust for cheap goods and cheap labor, and are absolutely acting in solidarity with each other and taking inspiration from each other.
Well, and I like to go to the various Facebook pages, and you can find these comments from workers across the country talking about, you know, being they lost 10 hours or 20 hours, and on the same day, Walmart puts up an ad for holiday help. And they talk about how they can't get promotion. I mean, complaint after complaint. I mean, these are just people from across the country. David, what are your thoughts on how these low-wage jobs are covered, and how significant do you think this strike is?
Oh, I think this is very significant. The whole point of my new book, let me do a little ad here, the whole point of my new book, The Fine Print, is to tell you about all sorts of things business has gotten legislatures and regulators and Congress to do that nobody else has written about to rig the game. So what does Walmart do here? It doesn't hire people like the seafood workers directly. It hires a contractor, and it claims they've inspected and found, and somehow they miss people being forced to work 24 hours straight without any overtime pay and no breaks. Then when they can't deny it anymore, they simply fire the vendor, who may well set up shop for all I know and do it again somewhere else. At the same time, they make use of various rules that work against American workers. The workers in Louisiana, for example, were mostly here on visas. And then, of course, they have the local police to make sure that they can keep in line anybody, as in Los Angeles, Southern California, when there's any kind of labor action. And we need to recognize that the news media is completely out of a touch with. Stephen Greenhouse has a deep understanding of labor unions and workplace issues. There are a handful of other journalists who do. Salon is one of the few places that has consistently taken a serious look at these things. And we need to recognize there are reasons that we have rules about working conditions and labor, and that our competitors all seem to do just fine with rules that are vastly beyond anything we have in the United States. And, you know, I think people should be calling up their newspaper and saying, how come there isn't more coverage of this? Why aren't you telling us more about this? And why don't you have more opinion columns about this, both for and against it, and have a serious discussion, because almost all of us work.
Right. Well, and I'd like to know, you know, who called in the riot cops? What was the story behind that? Do you know, Josh?
No, but years ago when I was exposing the LAPD spying operation, I assure you that there's very close connections between major employers and all the large city police departments. Both, they all have labor squads. They have what we used to call red squads, the political spying squads, and they work very closely with business interests.
And the sweet deals that these multinationals get, I mean, you're talking Walmart posting $4 billion in profits just in the second quarter alone. Does this get much attention, David?
Well, it gets attention in terms of investments. I mean, the problem is the American press increasingly sees business through the eyes of shareholders, not through the eyes of the customers. In other words, you're looking at this through the eyes of the owners, in effect, instead of the customers. Well, you know, far more people have a banking account or shop at Walmart than own stock in those places. And that's part of the reason I think that the newspapers have faced a decline in readership.
And Rory, what are your thoughts on this? The other thing that makes this story fascinating is that these workers are using social media to get their stories out. So they're making videos of things, you know, like they're not being paid. They deal with 110-degree containers with no fans. They don't have access to clean water. And they talk about what really is at stake by going on strike. They know they could be fired. You're in L.A. Is this getting much attention down there?
Not as much as it should, is the short answer. And my own paper, we've done some stories on this, dating back about 2 months. But there seems to be a problem here with the media that, you know, basically walking and chewing gum at the same time. Because I think that the timing of the strike yesterday wasn't helped by, in terms of media coverage, by the fact that there's all this aftermath about the presidential debate, which seemed to suck up all of the oxygen and everything else. Seem to be just kind of a little details and crumbs to be swept into the corners of a website and whatnot, or just overlooked. And I just think the media often, we just have this kind of monomania. If here comes a hurricane, let's just focus on a hurricane in New Orleans, or I'm talking about the one a few months ago, not Katrina, or in this case, the presidential election. And unfortunately, these other stories, which are important and happening and floating often underneath our own noses, we just get overlooked.
Is this something that you could cover for The Guardian?
Yes, I certainly hope so. I would claim the fact that I was traveling yesterday, so that's why I was able to do the story yesterday. But a colleague of mine in New York did one version of the story several weeks ago. And so I hope that we'll be covering the aftermath of the strike in the next few days.
Well, so how does that work? I mean, would you go to your editor and say, look, for the first time in Walmart's 50-year history, these people are marching in front of the store? I mean, this is a pretty big deal. How does that process work?
Yeah, it would be a debate over, well, firstly, who would do it. Would it be me in L.A.? And except I'm about to leave L.A. again tomorrow, traveling, and I'm leaving California. So would it be a colleague of mine who's in New York, who's been covering the story from afar, or possibly even one of our labor editor who's based in London, who may do it from there. Well, that sounds peculiar, but actually that connection could work quite well. So, and again, it just depends often, I mean, it sounds kind of banal, but on a day-to-day basis, just how many reporters we have available and what else is happening.
Right.
We need to prioritize and make things. So often, in my case, I missed it yesterday because I was on the road and I thought I couldn't do it. And it's just as simple as that. So there's no kind of conspiracy. It's just unfortunate. And those sort of things happen a lot.
And Josh, you're a freelance journalist. You contribute to Salon in these times. When you write pieces like this about labor unrest and low-wage workers using their voices and walking off the job, what do you hear from progressive media outlets? I mean, do they want these stories?
Well, I've been very fortunate, both at Salon and in these times, as well as some of the other places I contribute, to have the opportunity to tell these stories. And this story in particular picked up online in a way that many of the labor stories I've written haven't. I think in part because Walmart is such a name brand.
Right.
People understand that Walmart in one word is the challenge to working people, is the challenge to the labor movement in the United States beyond. It was fun to see it tweeted in several languages all over the world. And I think people also, when they take the time to read the story, connect with the bravery that these workers are showing, because while the strike is legally protected, Walmart has over and over shown its willingness to play hardball. In Canada, to shut down a whole store that unionized. And what will make the difference in how Walmart responds, how it retaliates or doesn't for these workers, as Nelson Lichtenstein argued in the piece that I wrote, is what kind of reaction there is from the public and how large the actions are and what kinds of pressure they see from workers in other cities that let Walmart know what they can and can't get away with.
And they've also been slapped with a discrimination lawsuit by ex-female employees in Boca Raton, Florida. They've also been slapped with a sex discrimination suit, another one, from women in Tennessee. So it seems like things are kind of moving again on that side after the Supreme Court threw out the huge case last year.
Yes. I mean, David makes a good point about the way the law is tilted against regular people. And what the court has done to class action lawsuits has really set people back. But now we see this lawsuit. We see the congressional investigation of Walmart's Mexico bribery scandal, which turns out to be not just bribery and maybe not just in Mexico, seemingly, based on letters that were released on new evidence. We see the guest workers, three of them in Louisiana, who were part of that strike, have gotten special visas to stay in the country and plan to go organize other Walmart guest workers. We see Walmart pulling out of their plans to expand into New York. And so on many fronts, there are challenges to the company.
And I understand they threw a party at the Democratic National Convention.
Well, that is exactly how these companies stay in power,
right?
Is they're connected to both parties.
Yes. Important to point out the political ties also. Josh Idelson, freelance journalist, contributing writer for Salon, Rory Carroll, U.S. West correspondent for The Guardian, and David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He was on just a couple of weeks ago talking about his latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. You can find our interview at yourcallradio.org. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What will it take to shake up the U.S. political system? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with consumer activist Ralph Nader. He's out with a new book, The 17 Solutions, Bold Ideas for Our American Future. What will it take to create an inclusive political system in the U.S.? And do you think third parties have a future? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What questions do you have for Ralph Nader? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi, this is Edge Thompson inviting you to this week's West Coast Live, Saturday morning, 10 a.m. to noon here on KALW 91.7 San Francisco. We feature two interviews never before broadcast. The first featuring Salman Rushdie when he was still traveling in secret 16 years ago when he was in San Francisco. The second half of the broadcast with author Paul Theroux, the travel writer on the Tao of Travel. That's Saturday morning, 10 a.m. West Coast Live, WCL.org.
West Coast Live with Sedge Thompson tomorrow morning at 10. Information on upcoming presentations of the show can be found on their website, WCL.org. Up next from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that from noon to 2, Tavis Smiley here on Local Public Radio. And then this afternoon at 2, it's BBC News Hour, leading us up to All Things Considered at 3 o'clock. It's 11 o'clock, and this is KALW San Francisco.
Hello and welcome to World Have Your Say. I'm Nuala McGovern. a victory for Kenyans and protests in Jordan.
The dissolution of Parliament is not enough and it doesn't meet our demands, which are for genuine constitutional reforms and to come up with a new election law. The current election law is not acceptable.
The Muslim Brotherhood said it expected 50,000 people to protest in Jordan today. Well, did it happen? We're going to go to Amman to find out. Also this hour, three Mau Mau Kenyans who were tortured by British colonial authorities can proceed with their legal claims against the UK government. Well, some are calling it a vindication. Others say something that happened in 1952 should not be tried now as too much time has passed. Our guests in London and Nairobi are waiting to speak with you. You can tweet us. Use the hashtag WHYS.